This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's the toll-free number to call. 1-800-462-7413. You'll find the line open right now. And along with our caller, Zorba, some interesting things to talk over.
Yes, we're going to talk about turn off the TV, turn off the computer, and lose weight.
Oh.
Might be easier than you think. And we're going to talk about autism. Autism is a big issue. Is it on the rise? Why is it on the rise? Do we know why it's on the rise? And what can we do about it?
Okay, interesting stuff to talk over. What's our recipe?
Dandelions, snappy sauteed dandelions. I know dandelions are your absolutely favorite green, Tom. You just really wait for those dandelions to come out, but actually dandelions are quite good.
People do eat dandelions.
Absolutely. Used in Mediterranean cooking, you can buy it 24/7, year-round. All over the U.S., it's a green that we don't think about that is worthwhile thinking about.
Okay, we'll have the recipe coming up and, of course, our medical myth buster later on in the hour. Here's that toll-free number again, 800-462-7413. Zorba, let's get to the phones now. And our first listener in Makanda, Illinois. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Well, I have a two-year-old son. Well, he's almost two. And potty training's on the horizon, and there's so much out there, so many people telling me to do this or to do that, and I don't know how to get it started. I don't know what the best way is to get him ready to go on the potty.
Now, this boy is your first child, I'm assuming.
Yes.
Yeah.
So what are you going to do? What are your thoughts?
Well, I got a potty for him, a little one I just picked up at the store.
Mm-hmm. And, okay. A little one you move around, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it also has the part on top that detaches, and you can put on the actual toilet. You
know, right, that, right.
And I showed it to him, you know, and kind of, you know, asked him if he was interested. You know, you want to go potty? And no, he says no.
Yeah,
don't want to. That's right.
So the question is, how do you give your child value? Now, we all work for values in our society. How do you give value in terms of that? And I think the best way to begin to encourage potty training, first of all, is to take the potty, put it where you're sitting.
Mm-hmm.
Not in the bathroom, but in the living room, in the family room, wherever you're watching TV. He sits down on the potty, and every time he produces anything, he gets a little candy. That's
okay.
What you do. It's positive reinforcement.
Like
and
training
candy.
A dog.
That's exactly it. It's like training a dog. He goes there and all of a sudden he goes, hey, look, Mom. You know, look what's in there. And you go, oh, wow. And you make a great big deal of it and he gets some candy. And so what happens is he wants to go on the potty because every time he goes on a potty, he gets a treat.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are some people out there who are much more pure and say, no, 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 don't do this. You're encouraging bad habits by eating candy. And I say, that's a bogus argument. Candy has a place in life. And one of the places that life it has, it's in potty training. Right, reward. So let me give you a story. We had the Tommy Tippy potty. The Tommy Tippy potty was a one piece. I'll never forget it. And we had a wonderful, wonderful person who watched our kids, Grandma Terry. And she taught us the Grandma Terry method, which is, because she was always watching TV with the kids. She said, put it right in the middle of the living room. Have it right there. Who wants to sit in the bathroom all the time waiting for your kids to produce some, you know, urine? So right in the middle of the living room. But she went one step further because she had a bunch of kids that she was always watching in her daycare. She had the kids. She would give an older child. She'd say, you watch so-and-so. And every time that, you know, child goes potty, you get a treat too. So what happens is the older kids would carry the potty around for the younger kids all around the daycare and the house in order to say, don't you want to go potty? Don't you want to go potty? And they would sit down. And then everyone would be happy because they'd all get treats.
That's funny.
That's my recommendation. So I'm for the M&M theory of potty training.
Great. Okay.
Now, before you go, let me add a little word of advice. And this comes, Zorba, remember when I used to do a radio show with a child expert on a regular basis?
That's right. Yes,
her
that's,
point
yes.
on potty yes. training was, don't worry. The child will eventually learn how to use the toilet.
That's right. That's right.
That's something that I've been hearing, you know, that everyone agrees on. But I know kids that are five that parents
and they do it. The children do it at different times, and that's the whole issue. But gentle potty training, gentle reward, candy.
All right. Good to know. Thank you.
Sure. We appreciate the call. Thank you so much. 1-800-462-7413. Here's a listener now, Zorba, in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Fine. What's up?
For the past couple of years now, I've been experiencing some chest discomfort. Let me explain you how or more when this happens. Mm-hmm. This will happen, for example, when I'm typing on my computer for more than 15, 20 minutes or so, or when I'm laying on my chest watching TV in bed, for example. I wouldn't describe it really as a chest pain more than just a chest pressure, or almost restless syndrome on my chest. It's really annoying. And pretty much every morning when I wake up, I have some sort of stiff neck or pain in my neck that kind of develops into a headache or just goes away. So all this stuff has been happening for the past couple of years, and I'm a fairly active guy. So I play soccer 3 times a week. I play indoor soccer on the weekends. I run. I study at work. I mean, I'm fairly active, and I don't know what this could be about. But I had some tests done, and the only thing the doctor told me was that it wasn't heart-related. So other than that, I had no idea.
How old are you?
25.
Yeah. Okay.
Gotcha. A couple of things. Going to a doctor and making sure this is not in your heart, of course, is the first number one thing. And you, as you said, a 25-year-old, you're pretty unlikely to have heart disease. But sometimes people actually have, especially young athletes, can have something called idiopathic hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, where part of the heart actually gets large, can produce some chest pain and discomfort. So we've got a couple. If we look in the chest and we rule out the heart, which I think is, as you said, you're out there on the soccer field, it's unlikely it's that. There are two things that come to mind. Either this is from muscles and bones, or it's from your gut. It's from your stomach. So let's talk about muscles and bones. Is it in the same spot pretty much every time?
Yeah, pretty much. It's a little bit more prominent on my right side, but it kind of expands on my entire chest. And yeah, it's pretty much on where my heart would be.
And I have a question now. Looking at your chest, you've got the breastbone, which is right in the middle of the chest, and you've got the ribs that come out of the breastbone. Is it around where the intersection is between the breastbone is and the ribs? Is that where it occurs?
Yeah, it's pretty much when the breastbone starts to the right and to the left.
You have costochondritis. That's what you have. And we'll put that up, what that is, on the website. If you go to zorbapastor.org, we'll put that up. But basically, this is an inflammation of a joint. And the joint is where the bone of the ribs, one or two ribs, actually articulate or connect. They don't really connect. There's a joint there to the breastbone. And it's not an uncommon thing. In fact, it is a common thing. It's common in athletes. It's common in people who are bumping things all the time, which is what you're doing when you're on the soccer field. And the treatment is twofold. First of all, anti-inflammatory drugs, 2 Aleve tablets twice a day for a month. Over-the-counter may do it, but another treatment, which is often what has to be done, is they freeze the skin and go right a little bit beneath the skin, right to where it hurts, put a little bit of steroid, a little bit of xylocaine, and often that'll get rid of the inflammation and it'll go away. Mm-hmm. And that's what I would recommend doing. I'd get the injection and I would take the anti-inflammatories, because the injection is not that painful over the ribs. You're a soccer player, 25, you can take it. And the the injection will work. That's what I think you have. I mean, you play soccer, so you bump into things all the time, right?
Yeah, all the time.
It's not a complex injection. Lots of family docs do it, but you need to have that joint injected.
Well, you could potentially have saved my, you know, mind from going nuts with this, so thank you so much.
Oh, great. Thank
you. Our pleasure.
We appreciate the call at 1-800-462-7413. So, Zorba, click off the television and burn more calories.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's very interesting. This was a study, and it really comes on, if you will, on the back of a number of other studies. And this was a study that looked at overweight adults. And they said, okay, to carry out the trial, they had 6 overweight adults and obese adults, and they watched at least 3 hours of TV a day, which, by the way, is the national average.
Yeah.
The national average is 3 hours. And they randomly assigned roughly half of them, on 20 of them, to cut that time in half. half. So instead of 3 hours, they watch an hour and a half. They would keep track of it, and they watch an hour and a half versus 3 hours. Mm-hmm. Then they also kept daily diaries of what they were doing. And they estimated the people who turned off the TV basically burned 120 more calories a day. Doesn't seem like a lot. We burn about 2,000 calories a day roughly. So 120 more calories a day. Why? Because they weren't sitting on their butt watching the television, right? They weren't on watching TV sitting in the chair. Now, if you look at the 120 calories just by itself from an exercise point of view, when you walk at a normal pace for somewhere between 5 and 8 miles, you burn only 120 calories.
Yeah.
You don't burn very much at all.
Right.
So this is the same as walking comfortably on a treadmill for roughly 5 miles during the day in terms of calories. Those people, if you carry it out for the whole year, would have lost an estimated 10 to 15 pounds.
Yeah,
in other words, 120 calories translates into 10 to 15
pounds. But if you turn off the TV and walk over slowly and turn on the computer.
Yeah. No.
That's not going to do you any good.
Terry stuff.
Yeah.
In other words, if we look at the rise in TV watching and computer attachment that we have in our society, it parallels the rise in obesity. You know, everyone says high fructose corn syrup, that's what's doing it. So, you know, sugary cereals, maybe we're wrong. Maybe it's the fact that we are simply sitting down too much and we have 1 to 2 hours of extra television, which would burn off roughly 10 to 20 pounds of weight.
That study surprises me because you would think that if a person is sedentary and sitting watching television a lot, and you restricted the television, that the person would not do some active sort of thing.
Well, it's because people are bored. You would think that they would – well, you could look and say those people are going to go read a book. But the reality is people who watch television for 3 hours a day are often not voracious readers. So they were told not to watch TV, and in the end, they did other stuff. You know, it was a study. Now, whether or not they went back to their TV watching, I don't know. They probably did. But – getting up, turning off the TV, and limiting the amount of electronic stuff you have, that in and of itself may reduce your weight.
Interesting
stuff. Pull the plug.
Radio is all
right. Oh, no, radio is fine. Because radio you take with you. Radio is just fine.
800-462-7413.
Thank you for clarifying that time. Thank you.
1-800-462-7413. Here's a listener now in Superior, Montana. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
My husband is aged 79, and he recently was diagnosed with wet macular degeneration. Mm. And it's genetic because his mother had it also, although hers was dry. And about 40 years ago, he was diagnosed as having Drusen's. And is there a connection between the Drusen's and macular degeneration?
Yeah, I don't think that there's a connection between Drusen's and macular degeneration. But I have to tell you, I don't know if there's a connection there. Macular degeneration, wet or dry, is common. And whether or not Drusen's puts you at risk, I can chime in
on this because I've had a lot of eye problems. And I do have Drusen's. And they say that that is an indicator, but not necessarily an absolute indicator of macular degeneration.
So it might be that Drusen's are a signal of macular degeneration,
exactly.
But it also might be that Drusen's are coming. So once again, Tom, of course, was able to answer that, so we're going to make this the Dr. Tom ophthalmology show, but that's exactly
it. It's sort of a not precise answer.
No, but that's because you had it and you wondered the same thing. Yeah. So there's some, if you will, there's some association between one and the other. The thing about the injections now for macular degeneration, and these many of the injections are actually medications that were initially used as cancer medications, is that it may stop the progression of the disease. The macula is the part of the eye we use for our fine work, reading, watching television and the computer, and once it goes, we can't see. You know, it's a real issue with fine work, and it's a very important part of the eye. And luckily we now have these injections in the eye, which many people say are just, you know, they, before they have them, they say they're awful. But I found that people tolerate the injections very, very well. They're not as painful as you would think from the way that they're given. And they're given sort of in the eyeball, you know, in the back of the eyeball behind the white stuff, as the sclera is called, between that and the globe. So at least right now we've got some treatment for that versus dry macular degeneration. So good luck to your husband.
Okay. Now, is there a chance that the left eye will also become a wet?
There is always
condition?
A chance. There is always a chance. So there's always that risk, and we don't know how to prevent it. So, yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. We appreciate the call. 800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. On we go, Zorba, to St. Louis, Missouri now. Hi.
Hello.
What's up?
Well, I've been a smoker, I guess, for maybe 8 or 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I've tried a few times to quit unsuccessfully. I've used the patch. I tried gum at one point. I've tried to go cold turkey, and I always end up, you know, picking the cigarettes up again. So I recently learned about these devices, electronic cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
Although, as I understand it, they're not marketed as a smoking cessation device. But I thought, you know, I'm going to try it anyway. I'd read some different information on the web, and some people swore by it and said they quit smoking cigarettes. Well, that's what happened with me. I've been using the electronic cigarette now for maybe a couple of months, and I've completely stopped using cigarettes, although now I'm using this device, and, you know, what have I gotten myself into here?
Sure. Well, the answer is electronic cigarettes are not a nicotine replacement device such as the nicotine inhaler or nicotine gum or patch, and they have unproven safety and efficacy. In fact, what happens is they're really produced by the companies that produce them, that are tobacco companies, in an attempt to get people to say, well, these are safer. Electronic cigarettes are safer. But it's my understanding that these cigarettes also continue to use tobacco products. They're not just nicotine. They're derived from tobacco products. I might be wrong, but the last time I looked at that, that's what it said. Now, the real issue is that if they don't have proven safety and efficacy based on FDA rules, you can't depend on them. You know, whether or not they're derived from tobacco products or not, you cannot depend on them from a safety point of view because they don't have proven safety. The answer is they're not safe, they don't have proven efficacy, and they're continuing with a habit that is dangerous, like smoking. How do we compare with smoking? We don't know. But the reality is it's kind of akin to smoking. So you don't want to fool yourself with it. And they're marketing electronic cigarettes as a safe alternative. They're smokeless, so people can do them essentially in, you know, in an environment where they have no smoking, and that's really why they're marketing these things.
Okay. Well, thank you for your advice.
Good luck, and quitting smoking is always difficult. I smoked for 3 years, and I remember how hard it was to quit, so I congratulate you on trying to find the answer.
Thank you. Before the break, Zorba, let's take a quick question from the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox. This one comes to us from Jeremy in Fredericktown, Missouri. He writes, I am a vocal performer and want to know if you have any suggestions on voice care, such as lemon juice or other remedies to help with sustainability or range.
Well, voice care is a critical issue for anyone who uses their voice. We certainly use our voice all the time. And voice rest, because the voice, you're really using muscles, mm-hmm. is extremely important in between. A proper humidity in the air, very important. When it's too dry, like it is, for instance, in Wisconsin in the wintertime, it's much harder on the voice. Making sure that if you have allergies, that you take antihistamines for those, you know, for those allergies, mm-hmm. Trying to stay away from getting infections, which means using hand sanitizers all the time. Those are kind of the good things for voice care. And the main thing is that is staying away from tobacco and smoky issues, because if there's tobacco in the air, your voice is going to be a more problematic thing. What people don't always think about is gastroesophageal reflux disease, GERD. And GERD, which are the acids in the stomach, when they come up, they can actually come up, splash the vocal cords, and can cause problems.
Mm-hmm.
And the way to get rid of GERD is to make sure occasionally, if you have congestion, you take Prilosec over the counter, because that might do it if you have GERD. And for some people, elevating the head of the bed a little bit so that it's a little bit downhill, so basically acid doesn't splash into those vocal cords at night, that's an extra thing that you can do to protect your mm-hmm. voice.
Luckily, you mentioned we use our voice. Luckily, we have 6 days and 23 hours
in between.
To rest
that's
our
exactly
voice.
We don't talk for 6 days, 23 hours and 30, you know, that's exactly it.
If you want Zorba's help getting a lifestyle problem back in tune, just send us your lifestyle question in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Stick around for our recipe. That's coming up next. More of your calls, of course, some interesting research and our medical myth buster, all during the rest of the hour on Zorba Pasture on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Again, that number, 800-462-7413. Callers are waiting, but a line is open now for you at 1-800-462-7413. The recipe, though, before our next call, Zorba, this one for, of all things, snappy sautéed dandelions.
Dandelions. You know, it's not dandelion season. I don't know about you, but I think of dandelions in the summer.
Yeah.
Our house, our neighbors call our house Dandelion Acres,
because
we have so many dandelions, and I refuse to use insecticide on those, not insecticide, but herbicides on those dandelions.
And you ordinarily don't run out and pick them and saute them.
I normally do not run out and saute them. I don't think of it as a crop. But the fact is, dandelions are really part of a traditional Mediterranean cuisine. It's even part of a Chinese cuisine and Korean cuisine. They're roasted. Sometimes the root is used in a caffeine-like beverage. Mm-hmm. There was something called Cafex was sort of a coffee substitute, and they used to use dandelion in there. I don't know if they do it now, but it's become more and more popular. And if you buy salad greens, baby greens, in the grocery store, which I do now, if you look, a lot of them have dandelions in them. It has a slightly astringent, bitter taste.
Is it the stem of the dandelion?
Well, you can use – the dandelion can be used completely. If you look at the flower itself, it's made into dandelion wines. If you look at the leaves themselves, they're often – those are the things, the green leaves that are also a sautéed, sort of almost like spinach. And that's really the things that are used. The root are used for other things also. We look at vitamin A, and the darker the green, the more it has in it. In other words, so think about a dandelion green. It's darker than lettuce. So therefore, it has more vitamin A, vitamin C, K. It's got calcium. It's really good to use. And you can buy these now, dandelion greens, at a lot of larger grocery stores or ethnic grocery stores, Korean grocery stores, and so on, and try it. Sauté them.
The big problem with it is it doesn't taste good, but this recipe fixes that.
Well, it has an astringent taste. If you look at arugula is a cabbage that is not neutral. You have regular cabbage and it has a crunch to it, but it's neutral. Arugula has a slightly bitter taste. And about 20 years in San Francisco, they started serving arugula with other greens, and they found people like it. Mm-hmm. You know, just like lemon. Lemon has a sour taste to it. Well, we like it, but we add sweet to it, right, to make lemonade.
Well, I kind of like the lemon taste.
Well, then you'll like this. If you like the lemon taste, this is something you'll like. You know what you have to do? You have to go home, and you have to make this in your house. We are going to get you to make it. You may not be a tofu person, but you are a snappy sauteed dandelion guy.
Well, wouldn't it be nice if I promised to go home and
Oh, I can see your hands are crossing their fingers in back of you.
Okay, let's do it.
So start out with 1.5 pounds of dandelion greens, the tough lower stems. You get rid of the lower stems and discard them. You're using the leaves, and you're going to chop them, and it's 1.5 pounds.
That's a lot of dandelion, 1.5 pounds. That'd take up.
It's kind of like a sack. I mean, think of it. It's like a sack of spinach. You know,
a pound and a half.
A pound and a half. Yeah, a lot for you, but for people who like this, maybe.
Okay,
but it also shrinks down into nothing.
This serves 4 people.
100 people. It serves 4 people.
Yeah, okay.
But this is if you're having it as sort of a main course. You know, you could have it as a side course. 3 tablespoonfuls of olive oil.
Three big tea olive oil.
Not really a lot. 3 large garlic cloves. Smash them.
3 large garlic cloves smashed.
Now, when you cook with garlic, do you smash the cloves or do you get the pre-cut garlic in the jar and in the container?
Yeah, those are both acceptable
options. So we'll leave it just like that. You know, every time I go across the country, people say, does Tom really not cook at all? They always ask about your eating habits. What does he have for breakfast? Yeah. What does he have for lunch? You think we were married or something. You know, I see you once a week.
You think I was really an interesting person.
Okay. You got to be on Twitter. Ate this, ate that. That's what you need. A half teaspoon of hot red pepper flakes, dried. You know those dried flakes you use on pizza?
Yeah. A half little tea hot red pepper flakes, dried.
And a quarter teaspoon of either sea salt or kosher salt.
A quarter little tea sea salt or kosher salt.
Yeah, and the salt is less refined with sea salt and kosher salt, so it's coarser and it makes things taste saltier, if you will. Okay. Boil the dandelions in a large pot of salted water until tender. That's about 10 minutes. Discard, obviously, the water. Drain them and rinse them under cold water and gently rub out the excess water. And the way that I do that is I'll take paper towels when I have the dandelions in the colander and I just kind of push on the dandelions, and that's how it gets out. And I do that with all my spinach dishes where I want to get rid of the water. But gently, spinach you can really crush. Dandelions you don't want to crush. Then heat the olive oil in a heavy skillet over medium heat. Sauté the garlic and pepper flakes, stirring frequently until they're golden. That's going to be about a minute. It's got to be a low fire. If it's hot and you burn the garlic, it's not going to taste as good. Then increase the medium high. Throw in the greens. You got to throw in the greens. Increase the heat. Add the sea salt and saute until tender. And that's going to take about 3 or 4 minutes. And it's all done. And it's delicious. And it really has a very, very nice taste to it. It has a texture. And it's a nice taste. It's something that reminds me of spring. So it's a great winter dish.
And it's healthy.
And it's healthy.
Yeah.
That's right.
And it would go good with filet mignon and a baked potato.
And it would go good with filet mignon and a baked potato. That's exactly right. Thank you, Tom.
And if listeners would like this recipe,
they can come to our website at zorbapastor.org. They can get this recipe, go to the archive and find lots of our other recipes. And you can sign up for our weekly podcast. That's zorbapastor.org.
Is our toll-free number. Back to the phones now, Zorba, and a listener who's been waiting in Buffalo, New York. Hello.
Hi, Dr. Zorba. Hi, Tom.
How can we help?
I have a question about food allergies. It seems like for the past 3 years, once a year, I get a food allergy where I have a swelling of the lips, the tongue, and the throat, and like a sort of redness kind of inside the mouth. And the only constant I can figure out from this is shrimp. But I can eat clams or whatever during the summers, and it never happens. It just seems like November and December are the times that I get it.
Yeah. Does it happen every time you have shrimp?
No, it does not. And the odd thing is I went to an allergist and got tested for it, and he says I am not allergic to shrimp.
Well, the thing about seafood is that, first of all, seafood can be extremely individual allergies. Some people can have all seafood, iodine-type allergies, and all seafood can produce a problem. And other people, it's not all seafood at all. It's a very, very specific seafood. Now, is this shrimp in a restaurant or shrimp you prepare at home?
Oh, that's interesting. It's always been shrimp prepared at home.
So I'll tell you one of the issues. It may be the brine that's also associated with the shrimp because sometimes there's stuff in the brine. There's iodine, of course, in the brine because they have a lot of iodine. There's salt in the brine when they actually freeze the shrimp. And if it doesn't happen at a restaurant, which is what we just figured out, then it's either the preparation of the shrimp or the defrosting of the shrimp. So here's my recommendation. I would recommend you take, when you defrost shrimp, usually you do it under cold running water. You wait until the shrimp is actually defrosted. Then what you want to do is a couple of other things. You want to then soak the shrimp for maybe 3 to 5 minutes in clean water, not the water that came out, fresh water. And you want to do that 2 or 3 times. And then you want it to, so in other words, you're going to put it in water. You want to not just defrost the shrimp, but you want to get rid of the brine. So cold, fresh water, 2 to 3 minutes. Cold, fresh water, 2 to 3 minutes. Cold, fresh water, 2 to 3 minutes. Change the water those 3 times. Then take the shrimp and dry them in paper towels. Keep them completely dried in paper towels. Store them in a Ziploc bag with a couple of paper towels in them. And then I would wait, and I wouldn't use it for a couple of hours, and the rest of the moisture will go out and go into the paper towel. That may be the answer. I think it's the brine.
Okay. good. Can I ask one other question?
Sure. Of course. Is it food related or shrimp related?
Yeah, it's the same exact problem. If it does happen, I've been taking Benadryl to try to combat the.
Sure. You can take Benadryl is great, but you could take over the counter Claritin generic because if you take Benadryl before you eat, you're going to go to sleep. I mean, that's
the problem I'm having. Exactly.
Yeah, no, I got it. Hey, honey, let's make some shrimp. I'm going to take some Benadryl, and by the time the food is served, you're asleep at the table. No, I would take Claritin. Two things. Claritin and Zantac together may also work because it's an H2 blocker and it also blocks some of the immune response. So 300 milligrams of over-the-counter Zantac, that's 250 milligram tablets, and 10 to 20 milligrams of generic Claritin may work. But try the brine and see if that's the issue. Do what I said to clean your shrimp.
Very good. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Appreciate the call. Thank you very much. 800-462-7413 to Nibley, Utah next. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. How can we help you?
Well, I just have a question, a food-related question. Mm-hmm. I have some dear friends of mine that are, they call themselves foodie wannabes. They're trying to just eat only natural, real foods. And they're trying to, in the process, also cut out meat from their diet. Mm-hmm. And I'm not quite there yet with the no processed foods. I'm trying to eat healthier, but I'm just curious about the no meat part of the diet. Is there some part of animal protein that we as humans need, or is it okay? Are you sufficient just to have vegetable-based proteins?
Mm-hmm. Well, for many, many years, we thought you needed animal proteins because it has two amino acids that you can't, you know, find in vegetable proteins. And then many years ago, a book came out called Diet for a Small Planet, wonderful book where the author showed that basically a lot of traditional foods had complementary proteins. In other words, vegetable proteins are incomplete in and of themselves, but you look at rice and beans together and what the rice lacks, the bean has, and what the bean lacks, the rice has, essentially. So as a result, not only of that, but you can be a vegetarian or a vegan and you really can get plenty of protein. And you can do just fine. You do not have to have meat in your diet. On the other hand, some people like to have meat in their diet. I'm one of those people. And getting away from processed foods is a good idea. If you read something and it has more than five ingredients, it's probably fake food, as Michael Pollan says. In other words, it's sort of industrialized food. And if you have something with five or fewer, that's kind of his rule of thumb. But he wrote a book called The Omnivore's Dilemma, which is an excellent book that I highly recommend about how you get away from just industrialization of food. And I don't ruin anything, but in the end of the book, he's trying to actually make a meal that is totally free of industrial processing and free of industry. In other words, when he goes to the store, he doesn't want to use a car to get in to use a gas that supports the Saudis and the oil. In other words, let me make it. But if you're getting the seeds have to come from a natural seed for it. It should be free of industrial processing. And he fails. At the end of the whole book, it's impossible for him to actually make a meal that is 100% free of industry in one way or another. So the result of that book and other things I've read, I think reduction in industrial processing is a worthy goal. I think that's good. Developing a more vegetarian diet because, frankly, we eat too much animal protein is good. But on the other hand, if you're going to look at animal protein, low-fat dairy products have been proven to reduce high blood pressure. The DASH, D-A-S-H, diet, which was an NIH, National Institute of Health diet, looking at high blood pressure, showed that low-fat dairy products really are worthwhile. And so I think a vegetarian diet, is an excellent diet.
Does DASH stand for something?
Diet to Stop Hypertension. I don't remember what the A was. Yeah. But we'll put the DASH diet on our website, zorbapastor.org, so you can come and look at it. But getting back to your question, you can have meat. They're food wannabes. They want to do what they're doing. And frankly, you can be a vegan and do quite well. But if you're a vegan versus a vegetarian, which means no eggs, you know, no dairy products and so on.
And no cheese.
You've got to be much more strict and you just have to be more careful in what you're doing. And there are vegans out there who do quite well, but you've got to pay attention and read about it so that you get enough protein from other sources.
So even like I'm kind of in baby making mode. I've got a couple of babies and I've you know, planning on having more. And I've always heard that I need that animal protein in my diet for my milk and for my body, but you're saying that I can just do just as well with nuts and beans.
Vegetarians and vegans can have healthy babies, absolutely. Vegetarians and vegans. If you're a vegetarian, it's much easier because the animal protein you're having is from milk and cheese, so you don't have to worry about calcium. If you're a vegan, you have to do more work. Because you've got to make sure that you've got enough protein, enough calcium, and other things. But you can do that work. In other words, it becomes part of the process of what you're doing. You pay attention to that in your life. It's just like exercise. You spend some time looking at food, thinking about food. But yeah, as a vegan, you can have a healthy child. You just have to work at it.
Okay.
Good luck. Enjoy those babies.
I'm doing my best.
Thanks so much for the call. 800-462-7413. Let's log in now, Zorba, to the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox to get a tip for one of our listeners. This helpful hint comes to us from Sheila in St. Louis, Missouri, and has to do with one of our recent recipes. You'll remember acorn squash. Sheila writes, "You were discussing the difficulty in cutting the raw squash. I used to have this problem till I bought a spaghetti squash, also hard to cut raw, with a recipe label on it that recommended microwaving the squash whole. Wow, what a difference! Much easier to cut afterward. I adapt this method by microwaving the whole squash only partially, turning it over halfway through, take it out, cut it in half, scrape out the seeds, and then finish microwaving. This always works, no bloody fingers."
I think it's a great idea. I never thought about that. Microwave the squash, obviously, and then you soften the skin, and you could microwave it halfway and then finish it off in the oven if you wanted to and char it on the broiler.
Isn't that a great idea?
It's a great idea. It's absolutely a great idea. You know, it goes to show you how sometimes you just don't think of something that's right in front of your eyes, of course. And in fact, you could even just throw it in the oven if you didn't want to microwave it. If you're not a microwaver, you could just do it in the oven and do it for like 15, 20 minutes and do that. You just have to heat up the skin.
Yeah.
Thank you, thank you, thank you for showing us a good solution.
Do you have a home remedy you want to share? We want to hear it. Send your tips to us in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Interesting research coming up next. More of your calls, too. And our medical myth buster here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. From where? PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. But right now, Zorba, we talk about autism, and this is almost shocking. Almost 1% of the kids now have autism.
Right. There are a couple of really important issues here. It's the collection of data, how we're looking at autism. If we look back 20 years ago, the only thing we identified as autism was really the extreme form of autism, which was ritualized behavior and very little personal interaction. Autistic children who are at the far end, you know, don't make eye contact and don't interact in a way that we normally interact in. But then autism, the definition has been broadened to include other syndromes that are autism light, if you will, lighter. And I don't mean to make light of it.
But such as what?
Asperger's syndrome and so on. Things that have some of the qualities of severe autism, but not all of them. So a few years ago, they looked at data, especially in California and other states, and they looked at the number, and the number looked like it was going to be about 1 in 150 because they broadened the definition to maybe 1 in 200. But the latest data seems to show that it's about 1 in 110. And this is really important data. And scientists have looked at the data and said, how much of this is sampling? You know, we broaden the definition and we're sampling it more and looking for it more. And how much of this is the fact that it's on the rise? And the best people who have looked at it believe that autism is on the rise, that this is not just a sampling and definition error, but it's on the rise.
Do we know why?
Not at all. Not at all. Now, It's not just on the rise in our country. It's on the rise in Britain. It's on the rise in Japan. And in both those countries, they blamed vaccines. They blamed the pertussis vaccine. They blamed the measles vaccine. Then they blamed the mercury that was used to stabilize the vaccine. And pretty much when they stopped vaccinating in those countries, it made no difference. The autism continued to rise. And when we got rid of thimerosal, which was used to stabilize the vaccine in this country, it made no difference. It continues to rise. So although there's a whole industry involved and a passion of people who believe the vaccine is the issue, I think the data's out. We don't really know what causes it. And I don't think there's any evidence the vaccine is
and
the
I'm
issue.
And I'm assuming from what you've said that there is a variation in,
absolutely.
How, in how serious
absolutely.
This
and for
is.
Mild autism, some employers actually find it may be a benefit. There are actually employers out there who look for autism-like traits in computer programmers because they can zero in, concentrate, and sort of, if you will, take the rest of the world and just sort of block it out because it just is blocked out.
Whoa.
So for some people, autism may actually be advantageous to them.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, very. So the jury is out on what causes autism, but I do believe it's on the rise. I think the most important thing is to identify it early with your child if you have a question, and that means having what we call neuropsych testing and seeking help, because we know that the sooner you go in and help a child with autism, the better the result.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. And Zorba, a listener with us now in Spokane, Washington. Hi.
Hello. How are you guys?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, I'm a runner, and I'm calling to kind of get your feedback, almost a second opinion, on something called prolotherapy. I've been running, and I have had Achilles tendonitis before, and it started to flare up about a month ago, so I took some time off from running, and it didn't go away. So when I saw a doctor, he had an MRI, and he told me I had an edema in my Achilles tendon. And he suggested prolotherapy. And it was something that I hadn't heard about much before. And he said, hey, if you go online, there's some mixed opinions about it, but just think about it. And I just wanted to call and ask, what you thought of it, if you'd heard about it, and is it a good thing or a bad thing?
Yeah, Zorba knows all this, of course, but I don't. What is prolotherapy? What do you do?
As far as my understanding, if you basically inject some sort of irritant into a body part, and then that brings blood cells to that body part, and then it helps sort of speed up the healing.
Yeah, that is exactly the theory behind prolo, as it's called, prolotherapy. Now, I want to talk about the physician first of all. This is somebody who you know, or how'd you find this doc?
He was recommended to me. He's an orthopedic surgeon. And
okay.
He said that since my Achilles wasn't torn or ruptured,
okay.
that no one's going to operate on it. So
right. Right.
No one wants to touch it.
Right. What have you done for it? It's a painful condition. It happens all the time just when you run. What have you actually done for it?
Well, I've seen some two different physical therapists trying to get through it, and they've done some, various physical therapy things on it, and it's just not going away. It's just really stiff and uncomfortable.
Okay, because those are important things. Prolotherapy, if you're going to try it, you want to reserve it really for when other therapies have failed. So I'll tell you a little bit about Prolo. Prolo, first of all, is not reimbursed by insurance companies. So it's a pay-as-you-go therapy, and the reason is there were some studies done a number of years ago, not recently, that didn't show the advantage of prolotherapy. In other words, they didn't show that prolotherapy actually did anything, that was worthwhile. It's where they inject an alcohol-type solution, and the attempt is to actually cause, as you said, the cells to come in there and really make a difference. For some people, Prolo works. For some people, for many people, I would say Prolo does not work. So the real question for you is, what's the downside? It's an injection. It's in the Achilles tendon. I think what I would try before I tried prolotherapy is I would talk to the physical therapist. There is a treatment with electrophoresis, it's called, which is a steroid cream and a pad, and they use a little bit of electricity, gives a little buzz to the skin, to try to get the steroid under the skin into the tendon. And I think that's just the one other thing that I would try, as well as continue with exercises. And I think I would do that before I did the Prolo. And if that didn't work, then I would consider the Prolo therapy with this doctor.
Okay.
Were you impressed by the doctor? Were you impressed by the doctor when you went there?
Yeah, he's got great recommendations. And everyone has said excellent things about him. I double-checked him. And yeah, it was just something. He kind of confessed. He's like, not much I can do for you.
Excellent. I think doing your homework, making sure you have the right doc counts, and as I said, I would do step one, and if that doesn't work, I would try the Prolo. So thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. 800-462-7413. Zorba, time once again now for our medical MythBuster. Today's myth deals with something near and dear to both of our hearts, baldness. There's a claim floating around that high blood pressure increases your risk of losing your hair. Is this true?
I think it's a myth. Now, what isn't a myth are some of the observational data that seems to show that people who have heart disease and baldness, they tend to commingle. So in other words, baldness is not caused by heart disease, but it may be a marker for heart disease. And some of those studies showed that it may be a marker for high blood pressure also, because people with high blood pressure may have more baldness. There's no cause and effect there. I think what we know is that the data seems to show that if you are bald, get your blood pressure checked and make sure you check your cholesterol. But I don't think that there's any cause and effect. And I don't think high blood pressure increases the risk for baldness. It may just be a sign of high blood pressure.
Yeah, well, my hairline is going back and I have quite low blood pressure.
That's right. So you, of course, proved the fact that low blood pressure, a sample size of one. There's no doubt about it. We've absolutely proven it. And that's why you're on the show, to prove and disprove. Exactly.
If there's a myth pressuring you and you'd like Zorba to bust it, just send it to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Let's see if we can help another listener now. This one in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hello.
Hello, Zorba. Thank you for taking my call.
We appreciate it. What's up?
Well, for the last several months, off and on, my right ear has been plugged up. I realized that I was getting the plugged up ear every time I was in the house for a consistent amount of time, a day or two, and my ear wasn't a problem to me when I was spending most of my time in a given day out of the house. Hmm. So I've kind of localized the problem to some sort of allergic reaction to my house. But I don't know what it is, and I don't know where to go from here.
Well, the reality is we do get allergies all the time, and we often get allergies that things were around. So you may be allergic to something in the house. Dogs or cats or animals, parrots?
Well, we have a cat, but we've had the cat for 13 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, you could still be allergic to the cat after 13 years. So the cat is the first issue because it's just a common thing. And you're not going to get rid of the cat because the cat is part of your house.
Right.
You'd sooner live with that. But it may not be due to that. Do you take over-the-counter Claritin or decongestants? What do you take for
I've been taking Claritin and nasal decongestant when I have the blocked up ear, and it takes usually a day or a day and a half before I'm finally relieved.
Mm-hmm. Has that helped?
Yeah, it helps.
It helps a bit. Mm-hmm. So you want to look at air ventilation in your house. That's one of the things you want to do. A couple of suggestions. Go look at ion. They're called ions. They're ion air purifiers. And what they do is they actually throw charges, electrical charges into the air. And as a result, some of the dust and the pollen and the dander actually stick to the wall. If you look at the wall carefully, you'll actually see the dust is on the wall. So it makes it sticky. That's the first thing I would do.
Uh-huh.
The other thing I would do is look at where you are and where your cat is, because cats are often the problem. And if your cat is around you all the time, when you sit and watch TV, does your cat sit on you while you're watching TV?
Yeah, sleeps on my feet.
Yeah, well, that's the issue. That may be the issue. So, you know, maybe you're out of the house and you're not around the cat as much. Cat is number one issue just because it's most common. So what you want to do is see if that's an issue, and you've got to experiment a little bit. And that's what I would do. And then continue with your decongestant. It's something in the house. Animals are number one, but dust can be number two. And look at an ion, the little contraptions that throw ions into the air. So.
Why would the allergy be activated 13 years after we got the cat?
Yes, that's right.
It would.
That's right. Yes, that's right.
Yes, that's right.
Yes, that's right. Yes, that's right.
All right.
Yeah. That's life, isn't it?
It is.
You know,
okay.
Why does it snow some days and other days it rains, another day it's sunny, you know? That's life.
It just does that.
That's right. So good luck to you.
All right. Thanks very much.
And enjoy the cat.
Yeah, thank you.
We appreciate the call. Before we leave for the week, Zorba, we finally, during the hour, get to these beautiful looking and
gorgeous
wonderful
cookies.
Smelling cookies that have been sitting in front of us for the hour. Here's the deal. This is a special segment. We're going to have a healthy cookie challenge. Now, this challenge was laid out for us from John in Stoughton, Wisconsin. Thank you so much, John, for hand-delivering these wonderful-looking and smelling cookies to us at the station. Well, John has prepared three different styles of cookies: cinnamon stars, Mocha Cookies, and Springerly, I think, S-P-R-I-N-G-E-R-L-E, Springerly Cookies, and wants us to see if we can pick out the healthy cookie just by taste alone. He says one of these cookies has no butter, no oil, no flour, no salt. Our producer, Adam, has sealed the answer in this envelope and will open it after we make our guess. Is there a prize, Adam? What do we get for
the prize? Shakes his head.
And we get to eat the cookies. Okay.
So,
all right.
So we're going to do the same one here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not going to make my comment until I eat all.
No, but we're going to test them in the same way. Well, you can comment now. What do you think?
Oh, it's delicious.
Heart healthy or not?
Delicious.
I agree with you. I don't think that is either. Why
do we think it's not?
Because it tastes so good.
That's right. Exactly right. Okay. It tastes too good. It can't be out of it. Okay, this
here's the Springerly. Let me get a little sip of water.
The Springerly is good.
Let me taste.
It's got anise in it.
Oh,
you know, I'm going to take pictures of these cookies with my iPhone. And if it works, we're going to put them up on the website.
Oh, good idea. Yeah. These are good, too. But you know what?
This
might be heart healthy.
Maybe.
It tastes delicious, though.
We've got to be careful.
Oops, I shouldn't have taken a second bite. Okay.
And now we've got the mocha.
Sip of water. Okay, mocha.
The mocha is delicious. Not. It's too good.
Wait a minute. Let me think. I think we're in agreement on this.
I'm too good. Okay. We've got to get on with the show. People are listening. Okay. So, Springerly, that's my guess. Springerly is heart healthy. All three are great, though.
And we're staking everything on this.
Everything. The entire price of nothing is actually on there. And let's see.
Okay,
and Tom,
he's
opening up the letter as we speak. And the answer is?
Cinnamon Star.
Oh, my goodness. We were wrong. It's the Cinnamon Star, which is absolutely delicious.
If you guessed these were the most healthy, you were right. We did not.
We failed. Egg whites,
cinnamon, powdered sugar, ground almonds.
Wow.
So the Cinnamon Stars, and we both blew it.
That's right. And all three cookies were absolutely delicious. Thank you so much for this challenge, and you fooled us.
And if you have another challenge for us, we want to hear from you. Just send your email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Take care and stay well, Tom.
Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Beavis and Butthead, also known as Adam Friedrich and Brad Kohlberg, or Brad Kohlberg and Adam Friedrich, depending on who's who, are the two clowns on the other side of the glass producing this hour. Our executive producer is Beavis Friedrich, and our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0101Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.